Welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, April the 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here is our first story. It's entitled Solar Array to Power Dubuque Airport Terminal. While supply chain woes have delayed the project, installation is now underway. It's written by Andy Piper. With the quest to bring regular commercial air service back to Dubuque ongoing and Avilo Airlines winding down service to Orlando, Florida for the season, Dubuque Regional Airport might be considered a quiet place until Avilo returns in November. The airport, however, is humming along. Several capital improvement projects are underway, and the still-busy airfield ranks number two among Iowa airports for takeoffs and landings. While it has taken a couple of years to get off the ground, a solar energy project soon should see the light of day. Eagle Point solar crews are beginning to install a solar array there this week. The array is being constructed just west of the Captain Robert L. Martin Terminal parking lot. Electricity produced by the solar array will power the terminal building and apron lighting. It will offset $80,000 to $100,000 of airport electrical costs annually, according to Todd Dalzing, airport director. Batteries will be installed to store electricity to meet the terminal's needs at night. We have been working with Maquoketa Valley Electric Cooperative, and they tell us it will be the largest solar system on the grid, actually by about two times, Dalzing said. The project got its start 2 years ago when a new federal funding stream targeting terminal upgrades was announced. Airport officials applied and qualified for the funding. We thought it would fit in perfectly, and it was great that we were able to get this funding and provide power to the terminal, Dalzing said. It's been almost 2 years in the making because they had an issue with supply chain. There was an electric component that we had to wait for, so this project is taking a little longer than we are used to. The Federal Aviation Administration grant is covering 95% of the $1.5 million project, with federal pandemic relief funds being applied to the other 5%. Dalzing said airport officials will consider other solar energy opportunities in the future, targeting airfield lighting and another phase to power general aviation facilities. Dalzing addressed the Dubuque City Council recently as part of the airport's fiscal year 2025 budget presentation. He highlighted several ongoing and future projects. Phase two of a major taxiway rehabilitation is underway for about $5.9 million. Phase three is scheduled for fiscal year 2025 at an additional $5 million. Both phases are 90% FAA funded. Phase one of an apron reconstruction project is underway for about $3.2 million. The project covers about 15,000 square yards of the general aviation parking area. In 2022, the FAA deemed the apron pavement to be in poor condition. That justified our request for federal funding, Dalzing said. The project will rely on the bipartisan infrastructure law for 95% of the funding. The state of Iowa is contributing $400,000 from its airport improvement budget, and federal pandemic relief funds will cover the 5% local match. A safety improvement is proposed inside the terminal to meet federal security requirements. The airport would install exit lanes for passengers entering the terminal after disembarking their flights. Dalzing said a grant is being prepared and construction is contingent upon receiving that funding. Customer service facility fees will be used in conjunction with the approximately $300,000 project. Dalzing said the airport receives a small fee each time someone rents a car at the airport. Dalzing reported that in 2023, Dubuque and Planments totaled 19,022 outbound passengers. That figure is significant because exceeding 10,000 enplanements and triggers an automatic $1 million in FAA capital improvement funds. If we get below 10,000, Dubuque would receive only about $150,000, Dalzing said. 84 aircraft are based at the airport. That is the third highest total in the state behind Cedar Rapids at 128 and Des Moines at 105. The University of Dubuque program continues to grow, Dalzing said. They are proposing an additional 10 aircraft this summer. With a big assist from UD, Dubuque ranked number two in Iowa for aircraft operations, takeoffs, and landings in 2023 at 72,067. Des Moines, where another flight school recently opened, ranked number one at 110,000. Dalzing estimates UD is responsible for about half of those takeoffs and landings, but that the airport would still rank number three in Iowa without them. I was so impressed when I came out for my tour with just how busy our airport is, even though we don't have commercial service right now, Councilmember Katie Wethel said during the budget presentation. Dalzing also reported that the airport netted a profit of $1,158,404 from the sale of aviation fuel. That's not an airport that is anywhere near closing or not active at all, Dubuque Mayor Brad Kavanaugh said, noting continued efforts to return daily commercial service to Dubuque after American Airlines halted service there in 2022. Failure is not an option. We are getting commercial air service back. It is going to happen because this community deserves it. Traffic at the airport will shift some after this weekend as Avilo Airlines pauses its twice weekly flights between Dubuque and Orlando and moves to a seasonal flight schedule. Avilo has indicated it will resume its Orlando service in November. They have assured us at this point, obviously, there are operational changes, etc., but we are currently on schedule to restart in November, and we anticipate Wednesday and Saturday flights in the fall, Dalzing said. Our next article is entitled, Local Residents Still Fighting Rent Hikes. Table Mound Neighborhood Association members say rent increases are excessive and maintenance is poor at Mobile Home Park. This is written by Maya Bond. The residents of Table Mound Mobile Home Park have not stopped mobilizing. People living in the park at Key West, Iowa, continue to advocate for new tenant protection laws while expressing their disagreement with the owner of their park, Impact Communities. Ultimately, they say they are fighting for their homes. Since Impact MHC Management LLC, formerly RV Horizons Incorporated, bought the Dubuque Park in 2017, residents have fought against what they call excessive rent hikes and subpar maintenance. Residents said in the years since Impact bought the park, the rent on the land where their homes sit has doubled, and water, sewage, and garbage that used to be included in rent are now paid separately, Neighborhood Association President Carla Krapfel said. Members of the Table Mound Neighborhood Association have complained to local and state officials for years about the owner of the park, but few substantial changes have been made. Impact MHC Management LLC did not respond to requests for comment for this story. More recently, a few Impact staff members met with residents in January. Residents say that meeting largely was unproductive and happened after more than 60 residents complained to the Federal Housing Finance Agency. With the support of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, Neighborhood Association board member Carla Shepard recently asked Dubuque City Council members to consider passing a resolution supporting them. The proposed resolution also was passed by the City Council in North Liberty and states that the city stand in support of Mobile Home Park residents and calls on state lawmakers to address their stated problems. City Council member Laura Rousel told the Telegraph Herald she isn't sure a resolution is always the best answer for these issues. There are many topics we believe in, but of course we can't do a resolution on every one, so instead we have an action-oriented focus, she said. Rousel said the council's 2024 legislative priorities include calls to reform and review state codes related to mobile home community protections. She said council members also have participated in meetings with Table Mound residents over the years. Mayor Brad Kavanaugh said he is wary of passing a resolution without any actions to back it up. State law prohibits the city from enforcing measures that prevent mobile home park owners from increasing rent. This leaves local officials with few options to help, Kavanaugh said. If there's something we can do to make this move more quickly, I want to do it, he said. If that is a resolution, that's great, but sometimes it's not. It's one thing to say something, it's another thing to do something. Still, Councilmember Danny Sprank said the council wants something to be done to help the residents of mobile home parks. It's just a horrific situation, so I definitely would support some type of resolution to help those folks out, he said. Iowa CCI community organizer Jamie Isguire said the resolution would be an important step in the city supporting residents. A resolution is not a pointless measure, he said. Otherwise, governments wouldn't do it. Table Mound residents have made their case to state legislators as well. Iowa Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat from Dubuque, has filed multiple bills mirroring the priorities of the Table Mound residents over the years. However, her bills always have stalled. While legislators have passed some updates to relevant state law, local Democratic lawmakers and residents have said those don't fully address protections they seek. I do feel hopeful because despite influential lobbies, the power of people coming together is greater, James said. Iowa Senator Kerry Colker, a Republican from Dyersville, and Iowa Representative Shannon Lundgren, a Republican from Piasta, whose districts partially include the park, did not return phone calls requesting comment, though both have joined in with other local lawmakers in the past to work on legislating mobile home tenant protections. While park residents' advocacy continues, they said increasing land rental rates remains a burden. "You've got a lot of elderly people in this park that can't afford it," Krapfel said. "We have a lady down the street who's 90-something, and she's taking out her grocery money to make up for the rent." Residents also complain of drinking water quality in the community. Debbie Hackison, vice president of the Neighborhood Association, said even though the park uses city water, old pipes across the park leave sediment in the water. Residents said that in the past, maintenance work to repair driveways, roads, mailboxes, and dead trees rarely was completed. Shepherd said progress has been made in the past year, though, and small maintenance projects have been completed quickly. Michael Link, a Table Mound resident and association member, said his rent has increased from $280 to $538 since Impact bought the park. He said the Iowa legislature is not doing enough to protect mobile park residents. "There's people in here that make $700, $800, $900 a month, and they're supposed to give them $600 of it," he said, of the property owner. "What are they supposed to eat? What are they supposed to drive? How are they supposed to buy their meds?" Sue Lucy, a Table Mound resident and association member, said her rent has doubled in the past several years and maintenance requests have gone unanswered, leaving her with a wobbly mailbox and roads riddled with potholes. "If it wasn't for my boyfriend, I would be on the street because I could not afford to live here by myself," she said. Our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald today, Iowa DNR plans to shift park rangers' duties. Some state park advocates worry about the potential impact of planned changes. This is written by Benjamin Fisher. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources has begun a plan to shift park rangers stationed at specific state parks to regional conservation officers. The move would mean East Central Iowa Parks, Mines of Spain State Recreation Area, Bellevue State Park, and Maquoketa Caves State Park eventually would have no dedicated law enforcement on site. The plan is part of a broader state government realignment envisioned by Governor Kim Reynolds and approved by her fellow Republicans in the Iowa legislature in 2023. Members of Friends of Mines of Spain, the nonprofit auxiliary group for the park near Dubuque, have voiced concerns that the change could impact law enforcement response times to area parks and further burden local law enforcement. Department of Natural Resources documents shared with the Telegraph Herald state that the goal eventually is to transition all department law enforcement personnel away from the current park ranger model. "The final vision is for all law enforcement staff to be classified as conservation officers," states the internal department memo dated late last month. "They will be responsible for enforcing all fish and game laws, boating and off-highway vehicle laws, and other outdoor recreational laws. State park operations will be exclusively handled by state park managers and state park natural resource technicians. Officers designated as conservation officer will operate status quo consistent with the traditional CO model. They will have no parks-specific patrol or enforcement obligations," the memo states. Jason Gilmore, who serves as park ranger for both Mines of Spain and Bellevue State Park, said the change likely will not impact local parks immediately. "They said they would be doing it through retirements and attrition," he said, "so I don't know that they would change things here soon, but DNR leaders don't have a time frame for what time that will happen that they have shared with me anyway. a document DNR officials shared with the TH on Tuesday in response to a request for comment states that combining park rangers into the department's broader law enforcement bureau as conservation officers can work because the two positions are busiest in different seasons. The current park rangers / future conservation officers will operate as current conservation officers do, meaning the same number of DNR officers will be on duty, but with broader jurisdictions, less focused on the parks. DNR law enforcement presence at both Mines of Spain and Bellevue already has been reduced in recent years since the department chose to not fill a vacant park ranger position at Mines of Spain and made both parks Gilmore's jurisdiction, along with a park manager who also shares time between the two sites. Friends of the Mines of Spain president Jennifer Tigges commended Gilmore and park manager Ellie Lineberg, but said the changes negatively impacted operations at Mines of Spain. "We have one park ranger who shares time between two parks," she said. "They, the park rangers, used to have housing at state parks, so they were always there. I'm really proud of the people we have. It's just really sad, but this alignment has been coming down the pipe for a long time." Gilmore acknowledged the difficulties he and Lineberg splitting their time has produced. "It's a challenge, especially maintenance-wise, trying to be two places at once," he said. "But we do what we can. Luckily, we have seasonal positions starting up." Maquoketa Cave State Park still has a full-time park ranger because that park has a campground, according to the DNR. Park Ranger Scott Dykstra did not respond to a call seeking comment Tuesday. Founding Friends of the Mines of Spain director Ann Ernst said she is concerned about the impacts the DNR's plan would have on local law enforcement. "For law enforcement, I think it's going to mean they have more to do at the park without any ranger there," she said. "And our park rangers are a lot more than just law enforcement. They have naturalist training and other skills." Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy said he just had learned of the DNR's plan, but that it could lead to some additional work for his department. He noted that his department largely has covered the Mines of Spain since the DNR ended the full-time ranger position there. "If that's what DNR wants to do, there's not much we can do about it," he said. "We would treat Mines of Spain just like we do a lot of our small towns that don't have a police force or not one that's full-time. We give them enforcement when we're passing through and maybe stop some cars while we're there to show that we're around, respond to some emergency calls. It's a pretty typical state unfunded mandate. Here's a state park, but you take care of it." Next is an article entitled "City Developers Ask Judge to Reconsider January Ruling in Galena Resort Lawsuit." Nearly 100-acre proposed project is on hold pending outcome of dispute. This is written by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald, and the dateline is Galena, Illinois. The city of Galena and developers for a major resort project are asking a Joe Davies County judge to reconsider a January decision that voided multiple ordinances permitting the development's construction. The city, along with the development group True North Quality Homes and BNV, filed the motion to reconsider in Joe Davies County Circuit Court this week. In a January court order, Judge John Hay found in favor of Galena resident Wendy Clark on one count of Clark's lawsuit against the city, True North, and BNV. Clark's lawsuit addressed the Parker Resort, which was set to be built on nearly 100 acres that includes Galena Marine Hospital. Plans for the site include more than 100 cottages, a restaurant, a vineyard, and many other amenities. Clark's complaint alleged the development would be a prospective nuisance and that city officials violated city codes and state law during the approval process for it. Hay found in favor of the city on 9 of 10 counts in the lawsuit, but found in favor of Clark on one count, which alleged a violation of procedural due process during two Zoning Board of Appeals public hearings when Clark and other citizens were not allowed to cross-examine the developer. He then voided all zoning ordinances and amendments that resulted from those public hearings, including approval of the planned unit development for the project and annexation of land into the city limits. In their motions to reconsider, The city and development groups argued that the lack of cross-examination during zoning board hearings did not violate Clark's due process rights. Under the rational basis standard, all that was required was to provide the plaintiff notice and the opportunity to be heard, which occurred at both zoning board meetings and at the city council meetings. The city's motions to reconsider states. In short, Clark was afforded the process that was due and cannot show by clear and convincing evidence that her rights were violated. The city, True North, and BNV also argued that Hayes' voiding of the annexation agreement was also in error. That relief exceeded the specific relief requested by the plaintiff, unfairly surprised and prejudiced defendants, and was entirely unrelated to the evidence and issues in Count 8 of Clark's lawsuit. The motion from True North and BNV reads, in their motions, both city and the developers asked Hay to reverse his ruling and reinstate the voided city council actions. In a progress hearing Tuesday, City Attorney Gregory Cox and Clark will have 45 days to respond to the motion to reconsider, followed by 21 days for the city and developers to submit replies of their own. After the hearing, Clark said she takes issue with the city and developers' arguments that a cross-examination was not required based on her reading of the city's zoning procedures. The lawyers will argue the legal merits of that point, but from a practical standpoint, what the city's effectively saying is, we don't want to do the cross-examining if we don't absolutely have to do it. When really, what they could do as a result of the judge's opinion is simply start doing it, she said. Sandra Lawrence, president of BNV and property owner Dave Hooten with True North Quality Homes, did not respond to requests for comment Tuesday. City Administrator Mark Moran said the city did not have a comment due to the ongoing litigation. A hearing and oral arguments in the case are slated for July the 9th. Here's three short articles from the News in Brief heading. Authorities say more than 40 animals removed from Delaware County residents. Dateline Manchester, Iowa. Authorities said more than 40 dogs and cats were removed from a Delaware County residence last week. A press release Tuesday from the Delaware County Sheriff's Department states that law enforcement on March 26th served a search warrant at 19761 258th Street near Manchester. The Sheriff's Department and Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship were investigating whether unlicensed dog breeding and sales were taking place at the residence, the release states. The search found numerous cats and dogs at the residence in an outbuilding, the release states. Four puppies, 15 adult dogs, 14 adult cats, and 10 kittens were removed from the property. Many dogs were kept in unsanitary conditions that lacked ventilation and contained excessive animal waste, the release states. Several dogs had severely matted fur and lacked proper grooming. Seven dogs and one kitten also were found dead on the property, the release states. The case continues to be investigated and charges are pending against the owners of the animals, the release states. New principal selected for Western Dubuque High School, Dateline Epworth, Iowa. An Iowa school administrator will serve as the next principal of Western Dubuque High School in Epworth. Ethan Lynch will serve as the high school's principal beginning July the 1st, pending approval by the school board, according to a press release from Western Dubuque Community School District. Lynch will succeed Jacob Feldman, who recently was appointed to serve in the new role of Director of Secondary Education for the district. The release states that Lynch is currently high school principal in the Adair, Casey, and Guthrie Center School District, a role he has held for the past 4 years. He previously worked as assistant principal slash activities director, instructional coach, and at-risk coordinator in Guthrie Center. Throughout the selection process, Mr. Lynch demonstrated a strong commitment to establishing and enriching positive relationships, continual growth, and providing opportunities to all stakeholders, Superintendent Dan Butler said in the release. Teen sentenced to probation for January assault. A Dubuque teen has been sentenced to 2 years probation for domestic assault. Michaela A. Rogers, age 18, recently received the sentence in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County after pleading guilty to a charge of domestic assault impeding air/blood flow. Per a plea deal approved by Iowa District Senior Judge James Coyle, A charge of domestic assault with display or use of a weapon was dismissed. Court documents state that Rogers wielded a butcher knife while arguing with her mother, Tia M. Browsard, age 41, at their shared Lincoln Avenue residence on January the 18th. Documents state Rogers threatened to stab Browsard before pushing her out the front door. Documents state Rogers also strangled her mother using the strings of the sweatshirt Browsard was wearing earlier on in the argument, causing bruising and redness. Rogers admitted to the assault when interviewed by police, documents state. Now it's time to move to the opinion page, and we've got an other view entitled Lessons from 1968 for Tumultuous 2024. It's written by Eli Lehrer of R Street Institute. He's the president of R Street Institute, and he wrote this for InsideSources.com. The stakes in the 2024 election could not be higher. Incumbent Joe Biden has accused Donald Trump of being willing to sacrifice our democracy to put himself in power, while Trump has claimed that the country is being destroyed under the Biden administration. At a time when it seems politics couldn't get any messier, it's helpful to consider some parallels from recent history. Specifically, this election resonates with the tumultuous climate of the 1968 election, a year that paralleled today's divisiveness, yet also heralded the resilience of American democracy during some of the country's darkest moments. That election 56 years ago was nearly a rematch similar to the one America is about to witness. 1968 Republican candidate Richard Nixon had lost to John F. Kennedy in 1960, and JFK's brother Robert Kennedy had all but locked up the Democratic nomination when he was assassinated. Domestically, incumbent Lyndon B. Johnson's expansive government policies stirred unease among proponents of limited federal power. Internationally, events like North Vietnam's Tet Offensive rattled every already shaky American confidence, which parallels declining support today among some Americans for allies in Ukraine and Israel. The period was further darkened by civil unrest, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and racially charged politics climaxing in the chaos of the Democratic Convention in Chicago that year. While Nixon won the 1968 election, it didn't settle national unrest. Protests, riots, disorder, and crime continued while inflation accelerated. The economy slumped. An energy crisis developed as domestic oil production peaked. Nixon's administration saw continued expansion of social spending, major new economic regulations, price controls, and ultimately the Watergate scandal. All this eventually ended in his resignation, leaving a lasting dent in public trust in the government, followed by dozens of new faces elected to Congress and a slate of good government reforms. Even this genuinely tumultuous period, which cannot be overstated how serious it was for the country and trust in government and our leaders, eventually saw a return to political stability and national self-confidence. Jimmy Carter, the next Democrat to win a presidential election in 1976 after Nixon, presided over continued economic stagnation and held the line on continued government expansion while reining in excessive regulation. Ronald Reagan's landslide victory over Carter in 1980 provided a path for the Republicans to continue the deregulatory agenda and focus on the Sun Belt states. All this provides reason for caution and hope. Caution first, congressional power and other institutions that held back executive branch overreach and the abuse in the 1960s and 70s have waned. Modern oversight has become more a means of scoring political points rather than a check on executive power. The presence of an aggressive but apparently stable peer superpower in the form of the Soviet Union made foreign policy solutions more clear-cut than those in today's multipolar world. Today, we likewise grapple with the speed of the internet and endless domestic and international mis- and disinformation campaigns landing in inboxes, tearing through social media, and infiltrating news outlets. Still, America shouldn't give up. The solutions of the past may not fit current circumstances precisely, but the principles can. New social consensus, renewed resolve on long-standing commitments, and pullback of certain policies provide a roadmap. history also recounts victories over seemingly insurmountable issues. The period between the 1960s and late 1980s was marked by progress on civil rights, American victory in the Cold War thanks to a defense buildup, and the taming of inflation. Ending price controls and new production ended the energy crisis and reduced real prices for gasoline. By the 1990s, new policing tactics and significant prison investments even brought about a long-term decline in crime. The development and expansion of the internet domestically and globally has primarily been a force for good, connecting people, lowering barriers to knowledge and expertise, and so much more. For better and for ill, some changes we are seeing today may become more or less permanent features of the American system. Of course, not everything will return to normal, but as the preamble to the Constitution notes, we strive for a more perfect union. Again, this was written by Eli Lehrer, who is the president of the R Street Institute. Now, a reminder that you are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Our second opinion piece is written by Henry I. Miller, who is a physician and molecular biologist and is the Glenn Swagger Distinguished Fellow at the American Council on Science and Health. His article is entitled, "Government Has a Role to Play in Stopping Vaccine Misinformation." Vaccines are crucial in preventing diseases, saving lives, reducing disability, and lightening the burden on the nation's healthcare system. Therefore, the government has a compelling interest in combating vaccine misinformation to prevent the promulgation of factually incorrect information that causes deaths. That is the argument presented in an amicus brief filed with the Supreme Court in Murphy versus Missouri by several prominent medical organizations, including the American Medical Association, American Academy of Pediatrics, American Academy of Family Physicians, American College of Physicians, and American Geriatrics Society. Vaccination is, after all, a pillar of disease prevention, and the CDC estimates that between 2021 and 2030, more than 50 million deaths will have been prevented worldwide through immunization. The brief highlights the commitment to public health of the organizations, whose members are actively involved in the delivery of patient care and the development of disease prevention strategies. The organizations represent hundreds of thousands of medical professionals who have witnessed the life-saving effects of vaccination and recognize the destructive potential of misinformation. The crux of the issue in Murphy versus Missouri is whether the government's challenged conduct transformed private social media companies' content moderation decisions into state action and violated respondents' First Amendment rights. The government's stance is that its communication with social media companies was non-coercive and intended to address online misinformation hazards by identifying content violating the company's policies. The amicus brief focuses narrowly on the effect of misinformation on COVID-19 vaccination, emphasizing how false information that encourages vaccine rejection hampers the vaccine's ability to control disease spread and save lives. It posits that combating vaccine misinformation is a legitimate government effort to prevent factually incorrect statements from jeopardizing lives. The brief cites studies showing the significant effect of COVID-19 vaccinations on preventing deaths and reducing mortality among hospitalized patients, an estimated 235,000 COVID-associated deaths in the United States prevented in vaccinated adults just between December 1, 2020 and September 30, 2021, and reduced mortality by as much as 40% among hospitalized patients. It also underscores the stress that under-vaccination places on medical resources and the worse health outcomes that result from increased strain on hospitals and health professionals, and thereby vaccines reduce government expenditures on preventable diseases. The brief also points out that outcomes are worse when healthcare providers' time and resources are diverted from clinical care to combating vaccine misinformation. It also debunks some of the insupportable claims made by anti-vaxxers, such as that COVID vaccines magnetize individuals, implant them with tracking microchips, or make them infertile. It emphasizes that although such claims lack credible evidence, they and other inaccurate assertions have contributed to declining vaccination rates, leading to the resurgence of infectious diseases that were nearing eradication and increased health care expenditures. Measles is a case in point. The most infectious vaccine-preventable disease caused by viruses, it illustrates what can happen when the public becomes blasé about vaccination. Before vaccines were available every year in the United States, there were 3 million to 4 million cases of measles, 48,000 hospitalizations, and 400 to 500 deaths. Measles was declared eliminated in the United States in the year 2000 after there were no cases for more than a year due to an aggressive vaccination campaign. However, the CDC issued an emergency warning on January 25th, telling the public to remain vigilant after 23 cases were confirmed in 8 states between December 2023 and January 2024. What explains that? About 92% of U.S. children have been vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella by the MMR vaccine before age 2, below the federal target of 95%, which would restore herd immunity. The physicians' organization's amicus brief reinforces the safety of FDA-approved vaccines and their life-saving role. It argues that misinformation about vaccines reduces immunization uptake, hindering their effectiveness as part of a well-functioning public health system. The legal timeline of the case involves a district court ruling in July 2023 that limited the administration's communication with social media companies. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals partially upheld this ruling, and in October, the Supreme Court temporarily maintained the modified district court order until a potential ruling in June. I join with my physician colleagues in urging the Supreme Court to rule against the spread of toxic misinformation and in favor of promoting public health. And again, this was written by Henry I. Miller, who is a physician and molecular biologist and is the Glenn Swager Distinguished Fellow at the American Council on Science and Health. Now it's time to turn to today's obituaries. And first we remember Arthur Art Landon, age 93, and a treasured member of a large, loving family, who was brought home to his Heavenly Father on January the 31st, 2024. Art graduated from North Park Academy in Chicago in 1946. He continued his education at Northwestern University, earning a Bachelor of Science in Accounting. He later received his CPA certification in 1952. He began his career at Arthur Anderson Accounting Firm and later transferred his talents to John M. Smith Company and JMS Homemakers. Art finally ended his furniture adventures by closing Polk Brothers retail stores in the Chicagoland area. Deciding to leave the city life behind, Art and Sue Landon, his wife, moved to Galena, Illinois to create Poopsies, a first-of-its-kind retail shop. They decided to retire and sold the thriving business in 2010. Art was a man who embraced life, family, and friends. While missing his laugh and smile, his family will forever hold his love and kindness in their hearts. Art's life will be celebrated on April the 6th, 2024, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Luther Manor Clubhouse at 5300 Grand Meadow Drive in Asbury, Iowa. Handicap parking is available. Instead of flowers, please consider a donation to St. Joseph the Worker Church, 2001 St. Joseph Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001, or St. Croix Hospice, 101 Elkader Street, Strawberry Point, Iowa, 52076. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.furlongfuneralchapel.com. And we remember Francis A. Marshall, 74, of Bernard, Iowa, formerly a Dubuque, who passed away on March 24th, 2024, at home, surrounded by his loved ones. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, April 5th, 2024, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, April the 6th, at the funeral home with Deacon David Roth officiating. Frank was born on May 4th, 1949 in Dubuque, the son of Alvin and Verna Marshall. He married Jean Carner on December 10th, 1968 in East Dubuque, Illinois. He was an equipment operator for 39 years for the city of Dubuque. He was an avid bowler, enjoyed playing euchre and fishing with the kids. In lieu of flowers, a Frank Marshall Memorial Fund will be established. Next, we remember Elizabeth Betty Christ, age 92, of Asbury, who died on Monday, April the 1st. Visitation will be held from 3 to 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, April the 9th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road, where a prayer service will follow. A mass of Christian burial will take place at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April the 10th, at Resurrection Catholic Church. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Key West. And we remember Maurice Jones III, age 11, of Dubuque, who died on Friday, March 22, 2024. Private services will be held. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Now we remember Paul G. McAndrews, age 89, of Dubuque, who died on Monday, April the 1st. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th, at Mary Frances Clark Chapel at Mount Carmel Bluffs, where a mass of Christian burial will follow. Burial will take place in Holy Family Cemetery in Piasta, Iowa. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, is assisting the family. Now we remember Kimberly K. O'Neill, age 60, of Savannah, Illinois, who died on Sunday, March 31, 2024. Visitation will be held from noon to 2 p.m. Sunday, April the 7th, at Law Jones Funeral Home in Savannah, where services will follow. And we remember Patricia A. Omberg, age 92, of Galena, Illinois, who died on Sunday, March 31, 2024. Services will be held at a later date. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory at 2595 Rockdale Road is assisting the family. And finally, we remember Vicki L. Ries, age 67, of St. Paul, Minnesota, formerly of Strawberry Point, Iowa, who died on Saturday, March 16, 2024. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, April 13th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Strawberry Point, where services will follow and burial will follow in the church cemetery. Now turning to sports, we've got an article entitled Beasts of the East. Fighting Saints clinch first conference title since 2012-2013 season. It's written by James Leitner. Kevin Reidler earned his third shutout of the season on Tuesday night as backstopping the Dubuque Fighting Saints to a 2-0 victory at Waterloo. In the process, the Saints clinched the USHL's Eastern Conference regular season championship for the first time since 2012-2013, with four games remaining in the regular season. Dubuque ended Chicago's four-year run atop the East and won a conference title for the third time since returning to the USHL in 2010-2011. They won the Western Conference in their inaugural season. For the first 30 minutes, the teams exchanged plenty of offensive jabs, but Reidler and his counterpart, Calvin Vacon, kept the game scoreless. Dubuque's second-ranked power play generated very little on its first two opportunities, thanks to a Blackhawks penalty kill that prevented any forays into high-danger zones. Reidler finished with 28 saves to improve to 26-5-2-3 with a 2.86 goals against average and 0.903 save percentage. His last outing, he dropped a 5-4 shootout loss to USA Hockey's national team development program U18 squad on Friday night. Vacon finished with 27 saves. Eric Paulson finally opened the scoring at the 11:16 mark of the middle period with his 24th goal of the season. Gerard Pekarich's initial shot caught the ankle of Waterloo forward Jacob alt-rector, allowing Pekarich to grab his own rebound and reset to Seamus Powell at the left point. Powell fed Beckett Hendrickson, who carried the puck below the goal line and sent her to wraparound pass to a wide-open Paulson in the lower slot. Paulson snapped a quick shot inside the left post behind Vaecon. Just 2 minutes and 48 seconds later, the Saints doubled the lead while enjoying their third power play opportunity of the evening. Noah Powell, Seamus Powell, Gavin Cornforth, and Paulson worked the puck around the perimeter before Paulson fed Hendrickson, parked to the right of the net. Hendrickson fired a shot along the ice and inside the left post for his 24th goal of the season and 6th in 12 games since joining the Saints from Sioux Falls. Waterloo coach Matt Smaby pulled Vaecon for a 6th attacker with 1 minute 42 seconds remaining in regulation, but the Saints actually spent more time in the Blackhawks' zone the rest of the way while missing the empty net on a handful of occasions. The Saints took a significant step toward maintaining the Dupacco Cowbell Cup, which represents supremacy in head-to-head games involving Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Dubuque, and Waterloo. They improved to 13-6-3 for 29 points, 3 clear of Waterloo, with Des Moines third at 9-11-2, and Cedar Rapids fourth at 8-10-3. Dubuque has just 2 Cowbell Cup games remaining, including 1 against Waterloo, while the Blackhawks have 3 games remaining. In women's college basketball, Clark adds to her legacy. It's written by Tim Reynolds of the Associated Press. Caitlin Clark is going to the Final Four this weekend with yet another milestone on her resume. She's the all-time women's Division I leader in points per game, too. For now, at least. Clark's 41-point effort that led Iowa past LSU on Monday night lifted her career scoring average to 28.47 points per game. That puts her number one on the all-time Division I women's points per game list, just ahead of Mississippi Valley State's Patricia Hoskins, who averaged 28.38 points in 110 games from 1985 through 1989. Clark's career average was 28.375 points entering Monday. She needed 30 points to pass Hoskins on the Division I women's career average list. Of course, she's still playing, so it's not certain yet that Clark, who is going to the WNBA after this season, will finish number one in women's average. Clark would need at least 17 points against UConn in the national semifinals on Friday night to keep her career average ahead of Hoskins. If Iowa wins Friday and plays in the national championship game on Sunday, Clark would need at least 46 points over the 2 Final Four games to remain atop the list. When the stage is the brightest, when the spotlight is the brightest, she's her very best, Iowa coach Lisa Bluder said Tuesday. She loves this. Some people wither in the moment. She just gets stronger in the moment. When it's her time, I mean, she's going to just shine. Clark is already the all-time Division I scoring leader with 3,900 points. That's 233 ahead of men's Division I record holder Pete Maravich and 373 again ahead of Kelsey Plum, who had been the women's all-time record holder before Clark passed her earlier this season. Clark also became the all-time three-pointers made leader at the women's Division I level on Monday night. Clark connected on 9 threes against LSU, giving her 540 for her career, 3 more than the previous record holder, Oklahoma's Taylor Robertson. Among Clark's other major women's Division I records, she's the only player in women's Division I history with at least 3,000 points and 1,000 assists. Only 2 others, Sabrina Ionescu and Courtney Vandersloot, reached 2,000 points and 1,000 assists. Barring something incredibly improbable, she will become the first 3-time season scoring champion in the world's in the women's Division I era. Clark's 1,183 points and counting this season is the most by any player in a season, topping the record of 1,109 by Plum. And Clark's 193 three-pointers and counting this season are another women's Division I record, well ahead of the mark of 154 set by Idaho's Taylor Pierce. In a somewhat related article, Iowa LSU Elite Eight game draws record 12.3 million viewers. Caitlin Clark can claim another highlight, the most watched women's college basketball game on record. Iowa's 94-87 victory over LSU in Monday night's Albany 2 region final averaged 12.3 million viewers on ESPN, according to Nielsen. Clark scored 41 points as the Hawkeyes avenged last year's loss to the Tigers in the national championship game. The viewership surpassed the 11.84 million who watched in 1983 NCAA championship game between Southern California and Louisiana Tech. LSU coach Kim Mulkey played for Louisiana Tech and was matched up against USC great Cheryl Miller in that game, which was won by the Trojans 64-58. According to Sports Media Watch, it is the most viewed basketball game on ESPN since Game 7 of the 2018 Eastern Conference Finals, when the Cleveland Cavaliers' victory over the Boston Celtics averaged 13.6 million. Clark's four games in the women's NCAA tournament on ESPN and ABC have averaged 6.83 million. Iowa will face UConn in Friday's second national semifinal at the Women's Final Four on ESPN. The winner will face either South Carolina or North Carolina State on Sunday. The national championship game will air on ABC. The Hawkeyes' 89-68 win over Colorado in Saturday's regional semifinal game averaged 6.9 million viewers on ABC, making it the third most viewed women's tournament game since ESPN started carrying the tournament in 1996. Iowa's last five games on television have surpassed 3 million viewers, including the last three that have drawn at least 4.9 million. And here's your rundown of sports on television today in Major League Baseball. We got the Twins at the Brewers at 12:10 p.m. on BSWI. I think that's Bally Sports Wisconsin. Braves at the Chicago White Sox at 1:10 p.m. on NBC Sports Channel Chicago. Cardinals at Padres at 3:10 p.m. on Bally Sports Midwest. And you got the Rockies at the Cubs at 6:40 p.m. on Marquee. NHL hockey, Devils at Rangers at 6 p.m. on TNT and True TV. And at 8:30 p.m., you've got the Oilers at the Stars on TNT and True TV. In the National Basketball Association, we've got the Thunder at the Celtics at 6:45 on ESPN. And the Cavaliers at the Sun at 9 p.m. on ESPN. In college lacrosse, UD sweeps lacrosse honors. It's written by Jim Leitner. The University of Dubuque's Sam Todd and Ryan Doyle swept the Midwest Lacrosse Conference Men's Offensive and Defensive Players of the Week after leading the Spartans to two wins in three outings. The Spartans beat Centenary of Louisiana 17-7 last Monday, dropped a 15-12 decision to North Central on Wednesday, and scored a 16-6 decision over Northwestern of Minnesota on Friday. Todd, a St. Louis native, scored 13 goals and added 6 assists over the three games. Todd tallied 5 goals and 3 assists against North Central. He won the MLC Weekly Honor for the third time in his career. Doyle, a native of Brighton, Michigan, recorded 20 ground balls, 11 caused turnovers, and 2 assists over the three contests for Dubuque. He is a 10-time winner of the Weekly Award. Last week, Doyle earned a spot on the United States Intercollegiate Lacrosse Association's Team of the Week. The MLC includes 4 other NCAA Division III institutions, Cornell, Lake Forest, Northland, and Northwestern Minnesota's. More honors for Kennedy for the second straight week. Bradley softball player Sidney Kennedy earned Missouri Valley Conference accolades. The former Western Dubuque standout earned the Pitcher and Newcomer of the Week awards last week after earning Newcomer of the Week the prior period. Kennedy posted a 0.67 ERA all while recording 28 Ks and 2 runs allowed in 21 innings while going 3-0. Kennedy recorded her first complete no-hitter for the Braves while recording 10 strikeouts throughout the game for the third time this season. In her second start of the series against Missouri State, she tossed a two-hitter with 8 strikeouts and recorded her 100th strikeout of the season, becoming the first in the Valley to do so this season. Offensively, Kennedy collected 3 doubles and 2 RBIs at the plate while maintaining a .417 batting average. And Rogers lauded by ARC. Loras College senior baseball player Daniel Rogers on Monday landed the American Rivers Conference Position Player of the Week for the third time in his career. The Grays Lake, Illinois native went 8-for-10 from the plate over the week with 2 home runs, 7 RBIs, 6 runs scored, and 6 putouts. He currently leads the team and conference in hitting with a .492 average. Loras split its 2 games to move to 12-5 overall. Elker lands WIAC honor. The Wisconsin Intercollegiate Athletic Conference selected UW Platteville senior Justin Eichler as its male field athlete of the week. The Muckwaginaw Wisconsin native completed the hammer throw at the UW Platteville University of Dubuque duel on March 28th and threw a lifetime best of 216-2, which shattered his own school record and became the 6th best throw in NCAA Division III history. He bested his prior top mark in the event by 10-10 on his 2nd throw of the competition and posted personal best marks on his 1st and 3rd throws as well. Eichler's early season throw is 19.3, better than the next best hammer throw in Division III. Adams honored by Hart. The Heart of America Conference named Clark University's Daniel Adams as its Outdoor Field Athlete of the Week on Monday. The freshman from Muscatine, Iowa, competed at the Central Invite in Pella and won the men's high jump with a mark of 2.10 meters. Adams also hit the A standard of qualification for the NAIA National Championships. He became the first freshman in program history to qualify for both the indoor and outdoor NAIA championships. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.